happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a very interesting program today because I'm going to set aside time for the audience to share their comments and points of view. I'll tell you about that a little later on. We always begin with health and healing. Then we're going to have another person who would not normally have a public forum, but I'm going to play something he has to say to see whether or not you agree or disagree in part or whole, and then give your own point of view. Also today, I'll be continuing with my ongoing historical series of looking at the world and world events from an honest and scholarly point of view. It won't be in the textbooks. Most people will not be aware of what I'm going to share today. Even scholars necessarily will not know this. I'm going to take you back to the revolutionary times and give some thoughts on who were our founding fathers. What did they do? What did they believe? Hopefully you'll find it of interest. Also today, we'll be taking a look at some of the issues involving consumerism. And specifically, I'd like your input on, have you ever taken a day and simply looked at your own life and asked how much time, energy, work, effort are you engaged in to support a particular standard of living? Not a quality of life, a standard of living. They are completely separate. If you do, then, wow, you're going to have this wake-up where you think, I don't need all this stuff to be happy. So we're going to take a look at that in depth and show you how we got to a place where we're just doing nothing but consuming all day long. And then we end up having to pay for it. Then we have to work at different jobs. And, well, you'll see how convoluted it becomes. Again, I'll want your input on that as well. I'm not having a guest today so that you become the guest. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. For those of you who would actively like to have a pregnancy, an intended pregnancy, a few things you should be aware of. It is my belief, working with hundreds of infertile couples, that it's going to take you realistically at least a year and a half to 2 years to detoxify and cleanse your body of heavy metals, of negative emotions, of resolving issues, emotional issues in the present or past, and even looking at your parents' issues and your grandparents' issues, because epigenetics can go back at least 9 generations. So something that happened in a relative long ago could be impacting you today inside your DNA. So all that we can do is prepare ourselves. Realistically, most people only be able to do some things like stop the alcohol, stop the sugar, stop the animal protein, stop those refined carbohydrates and all the highly processed and chemicalized foods. That's just the stopping of it, but the damage is already done at the DNA level. So then you have to take about a year to detoxify. And let no one tell you otherwise. It's going to take you at least a year and a year and a half. How do I know that? Because I've had the good fortune of doing a lot of clinical studies. Now, these were not medical studies. I do not do any medical studies. In fact, when people come to the retreats, I'm going to be very clear. Never do I treat any disease, ever. I don't do diagnosing or treating. What I do is I provide an environment and insight an introspection into what causes imbalances at the cellular level, whether it's something in the air, the water, the diet, something that happens to our body because we're too sedentary, something happens to our brain or our heart or lungs because of the quality of the foods we've taken in or the lack of quality of foods. And then people have a choice if they choose to reverse that. And in some of the longer studies, including the hair and skin study, which lasted a year, and then I redid it again for another year, with over 5,000 people. In fact, many of you will remember, we had to use RFK High School on the east side because it was the largest auditorium I could find in the city that was available. And we were busy every night, and we even went sometimes... We would go twice a night, like 6 to 8 and then 8 to 10. That was a long time to get the results. But we also found out that if you only do part of a protocol, you're not going to get the results if you do all of it. Just a little side story. I had seen in myself that when I was on the road for about 38 days touring, back then you actually did a tour when you had a best-selling book. You would go city to city. You would appear in very busy cities with media like Los Angeles, maybe 20 appearances in a day. You were just rushed from one to another to another. All day throughout the night as well, because a lot of the bit longer shows that gave you more time without interruption were in the evenings, overnight. It was a real whirlwind, and I couldn't even go to a restaurant, even a natural food restaurant. There was no time. So I had to take with me what I was going to take, and I would take different things that didn't go bad. And so in any case, I found that when I came back off one of these trips, about 2 weeks later, I'm in the laboratory up at the Institute of Applied Biology, and I'm sitting there. I'm working on some issues, and I was rubbing my forehead, and I felt something, and it was little tiny hair follicles. Well, I have male pattern baldness. All the men in my family are bald. And I was thinning and going bald, so I tried everything. High-dose vitamins, and nothing stopped it. And so this did. And then I had to figure, well, what was different? And I couldn't figure it out. Finally, I did figure it out, because I just went through, you know, an examination of everything that was the same in anything that different. It was what I was throwing on the road that was different. In any case, that's a separate story. So I did an experiment with friends who were thinning or bald, and it worked. But that's too small, and that wouldn't be considered significant. So then I put the word out, and we had 5,000 people show up. And to qualify, you had to be bald, thinning, or gray for at least 7 years, because the body, through stress, if through pregnancy, will go through times when your body goes in hair growth into a less than vital state, and you lose a lot of hair. Normally, we lose about 120 hairs a day. And we have anywhere from 75,000, redheads have fewer hairs, to 125,000 hairs in our head. And so if your hair was dyed, you couldn't be in, because we wouldn't know if the natural color came back, because that was another thing. Natural color coming from the roots up were dark. And so we had a group of doctors there and nurses who were friends of mine who were doing the measurements of people's hair, taking photographs. I had a whole series of photographers there because we had to have an establishing picture before. And then every 2 weeks for a year, we would meet, and I would give them insights on lifestyle and nutrients from foods and juices. And at the end of a year, I did not have a statistically significant increase. I thought, wow, well, that's a bummer. And so I said, okay, strike that off. That's the only time in my entire career that I did a health support group where the results were not statistically significant in a positive way. So about 3 months goes by, and I'm walking down Broadway, and this little guy comes up to me, about 5'7", and he's wearing a beret. He says, Gary, I see a hi. He says, remember me? No, I didn't say that. I said, what's your name? He told me his name, and he said, I just want to tell you the protocol is working. Look. And he took off his beret, and you could see that there was all new hair growing, and I'm guessing he's around 50. And it was dark. And he said, I've been bald as a cucumber for the last 20 years, and now all this new hair and a natural color. But he said, also, my skin is tightening up. My fingernails are no longer brittle. And he said, so it worked. And I said, were you in the study? He said, yes, I was in the study. I said, I wonder why it didn't happen the first year. And he said, well, I can tell you why it didn't happen for me and a lot of other people. We didn't do the protocols. What do you mean? Well, a lot of people came to socialize. A lot of people came to hook up with other people. You didn't know that? I said, no, I didn't know it. I come in, I do the lectures, and I leave. I answer questions, and I'm not there to socialize with people. He said, well, everyone else was. He said, we would go to a Chinese restaurant a couple blocks down, and every single seat be taken with the people from the group, and others would go to other places. People just weren't doing the protocols. I said, I didn't know that. So I went back to my office, and I got out the list, and we began to call and write all the people, and we asked them a basic question. Did you follow the protocols? The answer was no. 95% of the people did not do everything. Some of them did some things, like they would start to exercise. Others would have a glass of juice. But that's not going to do it. You have to do it all. It's one of those issues, and that's where I came up with the idea that imagine yourself on one side of the Grand Canyon, where you got a limitation or disease or death staring you in the face. And on the other side of the Grand Canyon, there's life. And you ask yourself, do I want to make this jump, this transition in life? Do I want to go through this discomfort? Do I want the possibility of major benefit? And the reality is, and this is not a negative, it's just my own personal clinical experience, 90% of the people do not give themselves the permission to make the changes at the level necessary to surrender the disease, the depression, the pain, and replace it with something more constructive. They're just wedded into the old dynamics of comfort, addicted to comfort, and wanting the benefits of change but not willing to discomfort themselves. And more often than not, those are the whiners, the blamers, the moaners, and complainers. Because the people really changing are not whining, blaming, moaning, complaining. They're positive. They're doing it. And you see this, by the way, if you want a really good example of this, I have some photographs up on my website. You'll see huge crowd showing up on a Sunday when we announced I was going to train people for the New York Marathon. There'd be 100 yards long and 20 people deep. It was 500-600 people. And it would be a discussion for about 2 hours of what to expect and what they had to go through. But mind you, they had plenty of time to get in shape. In fact, more than enough time. And we would take them out for a short little walk the first day, just a mile. And the next week, there'd be half that many people. And the week after that, half again. So generally, we had around 150 people, more or less, who would do the whole training. So what happened to the other people? Well, when they found out what was necessary, they just didn't want to do it. And yet, when you finish that marathon, and they put a medal around every person's neck, you realize you can do anything you want now because you've climbed that mountain. You're not Sisyphus, stuck rolling the ball up and having it fall down and learning no lessons, just repeating patterns of behavior through ritual. So we called, we found out, so I redid the study. And this time, they could not get in to the next meeting if they didn't provide the homework to show and their diaries to show that they were doing the protocol. Well, you talk about numbers reducing. We went from 3,000 to 2,000 to 1,000 within two meetings. So this way, we knew the people were in there going to stay with the protocol, and that's the same standards we have for all of our work now. And people show up and they didn't do their homework, they don't get in. That's it. You're finished. You were warned. You were told. We explained it. You agreed to it. And now you're breaking it. It doesn't work with me. So now we're getting phenomenal results, absolutely phenomenal. So that's where we found we could grow people's hair to new color, no matter what age they were. In their 70s, they're getting auburn or red or black or blonde hair coming through and thick. So you know, I just wanted to share that. That's because they really did it all. So just this is the takeaway lesson from this. When you commit yourself to something, what level of commitment do you give? Because that will determine whether it's in a relationship or your own creative capacities or your own ability to detox, because you can't detox in a week. You can only learn how to detox and get started, have an example of it. You've got to carry that forward because you've got so many heavy metals, so many toxins, and if you're overweight, they're loaded into your fat tissue. So it's going to take, realistically, a year to a year and a half. And then one of the most exciting results of a clinical study ever done, where we took all brain-damaged people, and it took 16 months to get them to where they could be, their doctors would declare they were free of multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and autism. So it's not something you can do overnight. Please remember that. And that's also true for getting yourself ready to have a child. You want the men want the sperm to be completely healthy. The woman wants the ovaries, the eggs to be completely healthy, and everything counts. So this is the latest study from the University of Birmingham. They say that women with low vitamin D levels may be less likely to have a baby after assisted reproductive technology than those with normal vitamin D levels. So there's one single piece of a puzzle, and this was based on 11 published studies in the scientific literature of over 2,700 women who are undergoing the ART, and which is assisted reproductive technology, which includes in vitro fertilization and frozen embryo transfer to achieve pregnancy. So this was published in Human Reproduction, but it just shows you how many different pieces of a puzzle are there to any problem in life. Well, for reproduction, that's just one of many. I would say there's at least 30 different things that person could do, but here's the nice thing. The people I work with never had to go through those expensive $50,000, $75,000, whatever it is now, the vitro fertilization. They had normal pregnancy. So you can do that, but you can't do it unless you really cleanse the body. And one other thing, from the Occupational Environmental Medicine publication, there was research showing that air pollution is linked to poor quality sperm. That's right, air pollution, particularly levels of fine particulate matter, is associated with poor quality sperm. And although the size of the effect is relatively small in clinical terms, given how widespread air pollution is, this might spell infertility for a significant number of couples. Or if you are able to have pregnancy, you may end up, because of the poor effect of the sperm, having defects in the developing embryo, where it wouldn't be autism, but it could be some stunted, reduced, or altered learning capacity, that there is no diagnostic capacity to determine what's wrong. So they just guess. And who would have guessed it was air pollution? Now think of how bad air pollution is on the West Coast in San Francisco and Los Angeles and in Phoenix. Major pollution, and it's hurting people. Something that can help everyone's brain. This is from Singapore National University. They have found that curcumin, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, ameliorates neuroinflammation and neurodegeneration and memory deficits. So that's really good news. And they published their new report in Neurodegenerative Disease and Conditions, Alzheimer's disease. Quote, several studies have indicated that neuroinflammation is indeed associated with neurodegeneration disease pathology. However, failures of recent clinical trials of anti-inflammatory agents, that means drugs, in neurodegeneration disorders have emphasized the need to better understand the complexity of the neuroinflammatory process in order to unravel its link with neurodegeneration. end quote. But then they used curcumin, which is not a drug. It's a natural concentrate of turmeric, the curry herb that has been used in Ayurvedic medicine for a long time, and they were able to substantially improve the brain and getting rid of a lot of those bundles of amyloid plaque. So curcumin for your brain, and especially dementia, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, and ALS. Also from McGill University, being mindful and doing mindful meditation can help you lose weight. And that's good. They found that moderately effective for weight loss and largely effective in reducing obesity behavior. Because when you're mindful, you're then thinking in a positive way about your body, about the choices you make, and about being focused upon, I don't need this junk food. I don't need anything that doesn't honor my body. Remember what I said last week in a show, if you were listening last week? I said, there comes a time when you realize that you do not want any negativity in your life. It serves no purpose. It can only hurt you. It turns off the DNA. So those people are diseasing, even if they're not even aware of it, they are. Negative, toxic, gossipy people are always diseasing. But they're not going, you know, maybe it's their need for their karma to, you know, meet their disease in this lifespan. Because you're negative, you're toxic, you're going to be sharing a negative, toxic energy with other people. Now, if a person's vulnerable, then you've taken a vulnerable person and you've caused their immune system to crash. So you have every right, no matter if it's family, friends, relationship, whoever it is, to say no. If you can't approach me with love, don't approach me. If you can't speak to me with respect, don't speak to me. If I can't find joy in your company, I shouldn't be in your company. We just have a really hard time getting rid of toxic people from our lives. As if somehow guilt and shame means that we honor our limitations and hence suffer. And because we sacrifice and suffer the health and quality of our moment that we're in by allowing someone else's negativity to penetrate into ourselves. You're not a better person for that. You're a better person from walking away from anyone who is negative, toxic, and those are the people that always blame someone else. If you're a blamer, you need help. You need some serious help. Will you seek help? Not at all. You believe everyone else is wrong, not you. Well, friend, the day comes when you're sitting alone and you're there by yourself because no one else wants to be in your presence. You put yourself there. And all the techniques you've used are going to keep you there unless you change. So positive energy is what causes us to heal. Joy, laughter, the positive emotions, the positive hormones. So something to think about. And finally, from University of California, San Francisco, and it plays right into what I just said, stress in pregnancy is linked to changes in the infant's nervous system, meaning the child is less likely to smile, less resilient, more susceptible. That's how powerful negativity is. Maternal stress during the second trimester of pregnancy can influence the nervous system of the developing child, both before and after birth. And these can be subtle. The child's temperament would be less engaging. There's a diminished ability to regulate emotions. This was published in the Journal of Development and Psychopathology. So if you're pregnant, keep it positive. It'll make all the difference in the world to your developing child-to-be. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're taking a break and being right back with you. Please stay there. like to welcome all of you. Nice to have you on board. I'm going to play a clip now from just a regular person, but a person who believes that we are unduly influenced by those in power. Now, you can agree or disagree in part or whole, but here's what he has to say, then I'll add my comments in, and I'm going to take you back to the revolutionary period to do so. Please listen in.
Hands, all too frequently, men with the mentality of gangsters get control. History has proven that. Lord Acton. I have spent a great deal amount of time in the Sons of Liberty Academy dissecting the heads of the Anglo-American Empire, namely the Rothschilds and the Rockefeller dynasties. I cover their rise to power and all their secret effort into spreading debt and death throughout the world. They are monopoly men that seek to eliminate competition, so much so that they view it as a sin. They warp our reality so that they can maintain control. They have done this in secret for centuries. Everything in secret degenerates, even the administration of justice. Nothing is safe that does not show how it can bear the discussion and publicity. Lord Acton. The Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are the real source of all the problems going on in the world today, as they are holders of the world's privately held central banks. It is not the George Soros, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Ben Bernanke, Jamie Dimon, Barack Obama, or any other paycheck player, paradigm puppet, or frontman. This hidden power has allowed the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers to enslave humanity with eternal debt through their rigged debt-based monetary system. This also allows them to buy corporations, governments, militaries, and ultimately you. This was only possible because of the power of secrecy that they have controlled for many years.
We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other publications whose directors have attended our meetings and restricted their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march toward a world government.
Thanks to the internet, they can no longer hide in secret.
It really almost makes you ask the question, would it have been better if we never invented the internet?
The most potent weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed, Stephen Biko. But while most people get obsessed by this revelation of enslavement and the masters that hold our chains, I believe ultimately it is not these men we need to fear or fight, as the problem lies within us, because we empower them. We sign for the debts. We join their military. We vote for their political puppets. We buy their corporate trinkets. We eat their factory food. In short, we are the reason for our own problems. I know this is a hard thought to swallow, but we must accept the consequences of our active or passive support for this debt and death paradigm that empowers those that would seek to enslave your children with their lies and debt. By walking away from their paper casino, you can take away the base of their power, the control of money. By emptying your bank accounts and not supporting their wars, you eliminate their power to steal other people's assets. By not buying the latest and greatest doodad, you slow the velocity of money in their corporate power system that pays no taxes. Buy real wealth that delays gratification instead of the instant gratification of the consumer mentality. By walking away from their factory food and corporate restaurants, you deprive them of your wealth and support. This is at the heart of the silver bullet and the silver shield. Decentralized, leaderless resistance that focuses our energy on what we can control while withdrawing our support for those that would seek to oppress us. The few who understand the system will either be so interested in its profits or be so dependent upon its favors that there will be no opposition from that class. While on the other hand, the great body of people, mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantage capital derives off the system, will bear its burdens without complaint, and perhaps without even suspecting that the system is imbecile to their interests. Lord Rothschild. The benefit is that once you come to terms with this realization, you can then see the power we do have to make ourselves the highest and best self. By focusing your efforts of not only walking away from their paradigm, but empowering yourself by getting out of the doomed debt paradigm and buying real wealth like silver, that will eventually empower you to have dramatically higher purchasing power when this debt paradigm implodes. You empower yourself by not sacrificing what is unique and special about you to sell your soul to a collective power that would suck the very life out of you to empower those who spread lies at the top. It does not matter if it's a government, a military, corporation, school, or even church. They're all collectivist organizations that use secrecy and illusions to empower those at the top. They do not care about you ultimately, and when they're done with you, they will discard you, leaving you only with the sense of, what was that all for, and why haven't I pursued my own interests and passions to make a real difference in other people's lives? By not wasting your fruits of your labor on the latest gadget, you allow yourself to get out of the consumer debt cycle and be able to find happiness, contentment, peace, and real wealth to lead a better life. By eating healthy, locally grown food, you will not only find yourself healthier and happier, you will be supporting those in your local community. The dual nature of walking away and focusing on things that resonate with you and ultimately empower you is at the heart of the silver bullet and the silver shield. Every dollar you take out of their paradigm limits the power the banks have over you and limits their ability to maintain this illusionary power that they have over the world. Not only are you deleveraging their paper casino by depriving dollar reserves that the banks use to create leverage and debt, but also putting that fiat money into silver and taking delivery, you deleverage their ability to run a fractional reserve bullion banking system. This will ultimately show that the paper promises are useless if there is no real metal backing up the paper receipts for the metal. In short, this is a silver bullet to defeat the things that you are opposed to. You cannot solve a problem with the same consciousness that created the problem. You need to see the world anew. Albert Einstein. The silver shield of owning physical silver promotes things that resonate with you, like having real wealth that cannot be taken or inflated away from you, or the delayed gratification that is so important to any successful venture, the ability to have your wealth outside of a doomed paper paradigm, and the real return of purchasing power you will have, and how we can use this newfound wealth to be a blessing upon your friends and family because they could not or would not see what you saw. And ultimately, we can show humanity how we can break the cycle of debt and death with the complete opposite consciousness of equity, peace, and understanding.
That was one person's point of view. I'll share some of my own insights, and then I'm going to open up our calls so you can share yours. Here's what was not said but implied, but now this is the specifics. This is from Paul Buchheit of Common Dreams. How 90% of American households lost an average of $17,000 in wealth to plutocrats just last year. America has been great for the richest 1% and is rapidly becoming greater for them. And this is the latest from the Credit Suisse Global Wealth Data Look. And these multimillionaires effectively shifted $4 trillion in wealth away from the rest of the nation to themselves in 2016. And so how do they do that? It's getting worse for every year for the middle class, where households lost $35,000 to the 1%. And housing wealth for the 90% has been converted into investment wealth for the plutocrats. In the 1980s, the housing wealth of the bottom 90% made up 15% of the total household wealth. In the 1980s, the corporate equities owned by the richest 0.1% made up about 1.2% of total household wealth. Housing was 12 times greater than super-rich stock holdings back then. Now they're nearly equal. So we looked at 112 million households that have been reduced to just over 5% of total wealth. So what this means in lay language is that those who are very wealthy can control debt. And what is it that is one of our biggest problems today? We're in debt. Credit card debt, $1.3 trillion. Student debt, about approaching $1.5 trillion. A person today going to college is not asking the right questions. Should I even go to college? Is there a way that I could postpone this and learn trades and crafts that are more likely to have me earning an income and certainly a standard of living? Instead, we're assuming that it's a rite of passage that every person should go to college. Well, let me tell you, every person should not go to college. And when we go to college, what are we going to college for? In the United States, the first 4 years, for a lot of people, it's just a drunken party. It's a way of socializing. It's a way of getting away from your parents. It's a way of, you know, befriending people. But it's not the same as if you were in China or Russia or South Korea or India. We cannot compete with any of these countries in science and math and engineering and many other areas. And one of the problems is because This goes back that one of the leads up to the dot-com bubble, if you remember, was when they were highlighting how really cool it was to work for the Silicon Valley titans. And what they showed you, and what friends who lived out there in San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, just south of San Francisco, would talk about, was the environment. And one of them said you could go into some of these places and they'd have virtual reality games going, watching porn. They'd be riding around on their bicycles. They'd have buffet meals, anything you wanted to eat. At any time you wanted to eat, you could work the hours you wanted to work. But everything was based upon making people completely comfortable so they were entitled to any of these distractions. Well, the reality is that these so-called wunderkinds produce very little. The people that ended up producing the most important were the old-fashioned, go to work, do your work, focus on the problem, come up with solutions, and it's not about you personally. You're part of a larger environment. But the young generation at that time, that would be the X generation, they thought it was about them, that they were entitled, they were enlightened, they were the smart ones. They graduated 4 points from Stanford. So, of course, they deserved all this distraction. Others learned from them, and now everybody wants a distraction. iPhones 9 hours a day is a distraction. So who's actually coming up with the great ideas and implementing them in a way that helps the world, helps save us, helps improve the quality of our lives? Not that generation, unfortunately. But all those people coming in, taking the jobs of many Americans who thought it was okay, they had worked for 20 years, the quality of their work was insignificant, in fact, they knew everything, meant that they could float out until retirement, they're gone. By the millions, they're being displaced by people who will work for one-third the money and none of the benefits, who come in to work, and they're very smart. They've got PhDs, and they're in their 20s, and they're willing to work for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, where the people they're replacing costed 2-3 times that, and nobody's paying attention. You better, just like all these 50,000 factories that closed. That's a figure we shouldn't dodge. That's a reality. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the people that control us, persons he was talking about, only care about assessing how can they manipulate a market, keep Americans in debt, buy stuff you don't need, make it very easy. No credit down, no signing money, no payments for 1 year. The car is yours. What if I can't afford to pay the car? Don't worry about that. Just get the purchase. That's what we're into. If you can't make it, oh, that's all right. We'll write it off and take a 100% tax write-off, and then we'll turn it over to a collection agency, and they'll collect the debt for us, and you'll be harassed. And if you can't, if depending upon where you live, you could end up going to debtor's prison, in which case the debt you have now is small compared to what it will be when they start giving you compounding charges on being imprisoned. Yeah, this is the world we live in now. This is the reality of the marketplace. We shouldn't be buying homes. We should be getting out of debt, because as long as you're in debt, you're under their power. As long as you're buying stuff that they tell you should buy, you're under their power. So that's just that article. One article shows that's just a sampling of it. And even the quantitative easing that nobody was paying attention to, where they were giving up to $84 billion with a B, per month. Who were they giving that to? No small businesses, no Americans, no people behind their mortgages. They were given to the wealthiest. This is from David Glassbrook of RT News. Quantitative easing, the most opaque transfer of wealth in history. Quote, it appears that the massive, almost decade-long transfer of wealth to the rich known as quantitative easing is coming to an end. Of the world's four major central banks, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan, two have already ended their policy of buying up financial assets, and they stopped doing that in December. Indeed, the Fed is expected to start selling off their $3.5 trillion of assets it purchased during 3 rounds of quantitative easing, and much of those, by the way, are junk. Given that judged by its official aims, quantitative easing has been a total failure. It makes perfect sense. Quantitative easing injected money into the economy was supposed to get banks lending again, boosting investment and driving up economic growth. But overall, bank lending, in fact, fell following the introduction of quantitative easing in the United Kingdom, whilst lending to small and medium-sized enterprises responsible for 60% of employment plummeted. And central banks have flooded the global economy with cheap money since the financial crisis, yet global growth is still in the doldrums, particularly in Europe and Japan, which have both seen colossal stimulus packages thrown at the problem. And this failure is substantial. So, just to put it in perspective, the so-called smart people said if we gave banks and major corporations lots of money, more money than they could ever make legitimately, and which they pay no taxes on, that that'll stimulate the economy. It did nothing of the sort, because that money never was given to the people, the small business people who hire the most people, 60% of all the workforce. Nothing was given to the right people. This is just one of their schemes, but it worked. So who are these people? He mentioned the Rockefellers. He actually, you heard the voice of David Rockefeller at one of these meetings. By the way, he actually said that. Let me just tell you, I'll share some exact quotes from David Rockefeller. These are exact quotes. Some are actually from his memoir. Quote, "Whatever the price of the Chinese Revolution, it has obviously succeeded not only in producing more efficient, dedicated administration, but also in fostering high morale and community of purpose. The social experiment in China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history." Really? Well, David, you rotting corpse, did you ever think that maybe 40 million dead Chinese and all the intellectuals and artists in Mao's Cultural Revolution, led by his wife, do you think that maybe that should have been equated as one of the worst, if not the worst, genocide in world history? And yet to you, he got something moving, so he should be given credit without criticism. At a 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Germany, which Bill Clinton attended, he said the following, quote, and this is what, and I'll read this. He said, you heard him say, "We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subjected to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. The supernatural sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national auto-determination practiced in past centuries." Wow. So you controlled the whole media, and they kept silent. In 1994, at a UN dinner, he said, quote, "This present window of opportunity during which a truly peaceful and interdependent world order might be built will not be open for too long. We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order. If the Council on Foreign Relations raises the hackles of the conspiracy theorists, the Bilderberg meetings must induce apocalyptic visions of omnipotent international bankers plotting with unscrupulous government officials to impose cunning schemes on an ignorant and unsuspecting world. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subjected to the lights of publicity during these years." Also, this is directly from his memoirs. Quote, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interest of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it." And how powerful are the Rockefellers? Well, let's just take a look. Beginning in the 1930s, the Rockefeller Foundation provided financial support to Kaiser Wilhelm's Institute for Anthropology and Human Heredity and Eugenics. In lay language, that was the eugenics experiment that the Third Reich used in order to justify killing all of the people they considered having mental problems, and then they used it on the communists, then the anti-administrative officials, and finally on the Jews. The Rockefeller Foundation funded Nazi racial studies even after it was clear that this research was being used to rationalize and demonizing of Jews and other groups. And until 1939, the Rockefeller Foundation was funding research used to support Nazi racial science studies at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. And the foundation did not alert the world to the nature of German science and racist folly that Germany and German anthropology propagated and Rockefeller funded for years after the passage of the 1935 Nuremberg racial laws. And the Racial Foundation, or Rockefeller Foundation, along with the Carnegie Institute, was the primary financier of the Eugenics Record Office, meaning if you're feeble, if you're not smart, if you're not one of us, you should be killed. And in 1943, the Rockefeller Foundation's Mexico Agricultural Project had provided such a success with the science of corn propagation that it was exported to other Latin American countries. In 1956, the program was then taken to India with the geopolitical imperative of providing an antidote to communism. In 1959, that senior foundation official got the Ford Foundation and later the USAID and the World Bank to sign on to the major philanthropic project known now to the world as the Green Revolution. It was originally conceived in 1943 as the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center in Mexico. So it was not about helping feed the world, but that's what people were told. And then look at the current trustees of Rockefeller. Richard Parsons, chairman. He was on the chairman of the board of Citigroup. And Helen Gayle, president of CARE. And Donald Kaburka, president of the former president of the African Development Bank. And boy, do they play hell with the African nations' peoples. And Martin Leibowitz, managing director of Morgan Stanley. And what top businessmen, the top cell phone maker from Zimbabwe, and finance minister of Nigeria. Now, there's a country whose economic model should be emulated by no one. It's utterly corrupt at every level. And then John Rowe, former chairman and CEO of Aetna, the people who make a lot of money. So it's the 1% elite. But he also mentioned the Rockefellers as a problem. He is correct. The Rockefellers, by the way, it started at all. John D. Rockefeller started as a clerk. He only took a 10-week course in accounting. His father was a con artist and a traveling salesman. He became the U.S.'s first billionaire with a fortune worth 2% of the national economy. He founded Standard Oil in 1870. It controlled 90% of refineries, and Standard Oil Trust operated 41 companies. It was called the Corporation of Corporations. In 1892, the Sherman Antitrust Act broke it up, but they still controlled it. It was once a giant corporation. Now it was still controlled by the Rockefellers as separate corporations, including Continental Oil, which is ConocoPhillips, and Standard of Indiana, Amoco, and British Petroleum, and Standard Oil of California, which was Esso, and ExxonMobil, and Standard Oil of New York, which was ExxonMobil, Standard Oil of Ohio, which is SoHio, and British Petroleum, and Pennzoil, and Chevron. They owned it all. Then they, in 1900s, they got into large railroads, coal and iron. In fact, here's what you should know. Their net worth, if you base it upon 2007 dollar value, was $336 billion. Billion. Wow. Or put another way, they were wealthier than all the other robber barons combined. The Vanderbilts, the Fricks, J.P. Morgan, Carnegie, better than Swearingen, all of them. And they became a symbol of corporate greed. They crushed competition through devious means, the cunning weapons, underselling, differential pricing, and secret rebates. And they had secret agreements that the federal government didn't even know. They bribed people to spy on competing companies. They coerced rivals to join Standard Oil, be destroyed. They founded the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, a major figure in Bilderberg Group, and the World Economic Forum, the Council of America's Brookings Institute, the United Nations Association. They founded Chase Manhattan Bank, now J.P. Morgan Chase, the Rockefeller Foundation, University of Chicago, Rockefeller University, New School. Real estate, my goodness, they gave the land of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Cloisters and Rockefeller Center and Riverside Church and One Chase Manhattan Plaza and Lincoln Center and World Trade Center. Yeah. And so on so many levels, he was correct. Now, I want to share something about about another group, and that group concerns the people who were involved in our revolution. And most people are not familiar with revolution. This guy says that he is studied at some institution or some school of some type about the Sons of Liberty. But before we get to that, I want to talk about, although it was primarily in the Independence War of 13 American colonies against Great Britain, fought in North America, it escalated to include various other parts of the world. Most people don't realize that France and Spain were colonists' main allies, backed up by the Dutch Republic and the Kingdom of Mysore, which is in India. And while Britain was aided mostly by Germans and the natives of North America, and the battles were fought on land and in waters of North America, Europe, Africa, India, and the Caribbean. But only 40% of the colonists supported the rebellion. Colonists were divided into three different groups, including those that supported the rebellion and the Patriots. About 20% opposed the revolution and remained loyal to the British crown, and the rest just didn't want to become involved. They wanted to remain neutral. And you've heard about Benedict Arnold, and all you know is that he was a traitor, but what you should understand is he wouldn't have become a traitor had Washington not been as political and Machiavellian as he was. Benedict Arnold was a general in the Continental Army during the first years of the Revolutionary War. He's best known, again, as a traitor who joined the British during the war. He was actually the best general in the Continental Army. He resisted the bigger British fleet in the Battle of Lake Champlain and won the battle at Saratoga in 1777, and that was considered one of the most important battles of the war. In the words of historian George Newman, the colonists would probably have lost the Revolutionary War if it weren't for Benedict Arnold. People don't understand that. So the facts reveal that Arnold supposedly joined the British due to his disapproval of the French alliance, but coincidentally, he largely caused the French to join the war by winning at Saratoga. And we all celebrate the signing of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. Well, it didn't happen. Did not happen. And I'll explain that in a moment. Not on the 4th. There were at least 90 other declarations of independence by states and locals before Jefferson. And the word independence never appears in the Declaration of Independence. Rather, it's titled the Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America. The Declaration of Independence was not signed on July 4, 1776. On July 1, 1776, the Second Continental Congress met in Philadelphia, and on the following day, 12 of the 13 colonies voted in favor of Richard Henry Lee's motion for independence. The delegates then spent the next 2 days debating and revising the language of a statement drafted by Thomas Jefferson. And on July 4th, Congress officially adopted the Declaration of Independence, and as a result, the date is celebrated as Independence Day. Well, nearly a month would go by before the actual signing of the document took place. And New York's delegates didn't officially give their support until July 9th because their home assembly hadn't yet authorized them to vote in favor of independence. And next, it took 2 weeks for the declaration to be written on parchment in a clear hand, and most of the delegates signed on August 2nd. But several signed on a later date. Two others, John Dickinson and Robert L. Livingston, never signed it at all. And by the way, the language of all are created equal was nonsense. It was never witnessed in the colonies. For 100 years before the revolution, there was class conflict and struggle between landlords and tenants and riots among the poor. And reality behind the declaration was a rising class of important people, that's what they were called, who needed to maintain a balance of class distinction to recruit and win over the underclass to defeat the British. And before and during and after the Revolutionary War, class uprising in cities and rural areas were even common, including in the Continental Army. In fact, Washington's army suffered from frequent mutinies due to horrible conditions, And Washington's elite class officers put soldiers through terrible situations. In fact, in one case, where a group of people had not been eating almost any food and suffering terribly, and the largest casualty of the war was disease, not gunfire. So a group of them decided to go to Philadelphia and complain. And so they went to Lyft, and about 100 yards away, they were caught and brought back, and all the leaders were lined up, tied to a pole, and then they were shot. But Washington didn't have them shot as it would normally happen. He had the soldiers who were going to shoot get closer and closer and closer until finally they were just a few feet from the person's heads, and they then shot them in the face and the heads as an example. This is George Washington, by the way. Not the guy we all thought he was. And also, Thomas Jefferson called the Constitutional Convention delegates an assembly of demagogues. And Jefferson was not alone among the founding fathers who gathered in Philadelphia. He was in Paris serving as minister of France, or to France. And John Adams was abroad serving as minister of Great Britain. And Samuel Adams and John Hancock and Patrick Henry, who turned down an invitation because he smelt a rat in Philadelphia tending towards the monarchy, also did not participate. Not all the delegates who attended the convention signed the Constitution. Although 55 delegates participated in the Constitutional Convention, there were only 39 signatures on the Constitution. And 14 men already left Philadelphia were not present for the signing, and only Delaware delegate John Dickinson had a proxy signed for him. And three delegates, Eldridge Gerry of Massachusetts and Edward Randolph and George Mason of Virginia, Mason University's after him, was dissatisfied with the final document and refused to sign it. And by the way, I don't have time today, but all these top signers had something in common. They were all Freemasons. Do you know what a Freemason is? Do you know about their secret society? Do you know who they were, what they believed in? I'm talking about John Adams, Samuel Adams, Ethan Allen, Edwin Burke, John Claypool, William Dawes, Benjamin Franklin, and John Hancock, Benjamin Harris, who else? Thomas Jefferson, John Paul Jones, Robert Livingston. Thomas Paine was a humanist, but Paul Revere was a Mason, and George Washington was a Mason. I'll give you more on them and where they came from and what was going on in France at that time, and also Jefferson's hypocrisy on slavery. And oh, you thought you knew about Paul Revere's ride? Wrong. The Boston silversmith was actually accompanied by as many as 40 other men on his midnight ride to sound the alarm. But 2 years later, 16-year-old Sybil Ludington, the daughter of a colonel, rode 40 miles on her own from 9 p.m. till dawn to alert New York militia members that the Brits were burning down Danbury, Connecticut. I'll continue with the history lesson on the Continental Army and the Founding Fathers and Freemasonry on tomorrow's show, but we're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.